of Rabiul Awal 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the first of the month of Meh 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 23rd of September 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. So in this day, this is today's special from IRIB English Radio, which says, Salam to all of you, dear friend. We start this episode by verse 20 of chapter Al-Muzammil from the Holy Quran.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. إن ربك يعلم أنك تقوم أدنى من ثلثي الليل ونصفه وثلثه وطائفة من الذين معك والله يقدر الليل والنهار علم أن لن تحصوه فتاب عليكم فقرؤوا ما تيسر من القرآن علم أن سيكون منكم مرضى وآخرون يضربون في الأرض يبتغون من فضل الله وآخرون يقاتلون في سبيل الله فاقرؤوا ما تيسر منه وأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة وأقرضوا الله قرضا حسنا وما تقدموا لأنفسكم من خير تجدوه عند الله هو خيرا وأعظم أجرا واستغفروا الله إن الله غفور رحيم.
Indeed, your Lord knows, O Muhammad, that you stand in prayer almost two-thirds of the night, or half of it, or a third of it, and so do a group of those with you. And Allah determines the extent of the night and the day. He has known that you Muslims will not be able to do it, and has turned to you in forgiveness. So recite what is easy for you of the Quran. He has known that there will be among you those who are ill, and others traveling throughout the land, seeking something of the bounty of Allah, and others fighting for the cause of Allah. So recite what is easy from it, and establish prayer, and give zakah, and loan Allah a goodly loan. And whatever good you put forward for yourselves, you will find it with Allah. It is better and greater in reward. And seek forgiveness of Allah. Indeed, Allah is forgiving and merciful.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The expression of this verse is lending Allah a goodly loan, and that is the most noble expression imaginable in this respect. Since Allah Almighty is the owner of all the possessions, and He is not expected by no means to request others to lend Him a loan, but He hereby urges the believers to expend and make sacrifices in His cause and obtain merits by doing such noble deeds and tread the path of spiritual growth and attain perfection. It is noteworthy that making mention of invoking Allah Almighty for forgiveness, as mentioned at the close of such divine commands, may reflect that, by acting upon such commands, man may not feel that he is perfect and Allah Almighty owes them something, but he is supposed to regard himself neglectful at all times and return toward him, since no one is able to praise Allah most benefitingly.
Allah.
etiquette of lending money is the core of today's episode. Islamic teachings do not always require borrowers to provide collateral for debts. Trust is a key foundation in these transactions. While collateral may sometimes be necessary, it is not the primary requirement in Islamic debt and credit practices. If collectors rely too heavily on collateral, the intention to help often gets sidelined. Islam places high value on trust-based relationships and emphasizes consideration of the borrower's ability to repay. Lending to a relative or friend without a formal agreement still requires careful consideration. Before extending a loan, the lender should assess their own financial capacity and be mindful of the potential risks involved.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to today's special. This is Ali, your host. We shall be talking about the etiquettes of lending and borrowing in Islam. The narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam also emphasize the importance of lending and introduce it as an act superior to charity or sadaqah. This is because Qard al-Hasan helps the needy person maintain their financial independence and solve their problems without humiliation. Qard al-Hasan is not only a devotional and God-pleasing act, but also have a positive impact on the economy of society. If the culture of Qard al-Hasan is institutionalized in society, many of people's economic problems will be reduced and social justice will be achieved. Therefore, it is essential to promote this culture among members of society and for Islamic and financial institutions to provide a suitable platform for facilitating Qard al-Hasana. And how about the etiquettes of lending in Islam? Lending holds a special place in Islamic teachings and is considered among the strongly recommended acts, that is, mustahabbat mu'akkada. This act not only unravels the material problems of believers, but also, according to narrations, carries great reward. However, abandoning it is not considered a sin. In Islam, lending has conditions and etiquettes, observing which completes their charitable act and increases its blessing. Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, a day you'll always remember every part.
Today's special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the
If you deny someone a loan, be careful of co-signing loans. This is one step to take before we lend money. If you aren't willing or able to loan someone money, they may ask you to co-sign a loan for them. A co-signer agrees to be held responsible in the event that the borrower can't pay back a lender or breaks the terms of their loan. You should be extremely cautious before co-signing a loan for someone else, as it comes with high risks and can impact your credit score. Established lenders, such as banks or credit card companies, may require borrowers to have a co-signer if the borrower has poor credit or no credit history, doesn't meet income requirements, is self-employed, or already has high debt. Now, this is today's special, and this is the Islamic perspective on that. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam would supplicate to Allah to save him from death. He would say, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from a soul that does not satisfy, and from a heart that does not humble itself, and from a supplication not heard, and from knowledge that does not benefit, and from a deed not raised up, and from a death that never ends. In another narration, the Prophet sought Allah's refuge from debt. When the Prophet contracted a debt transaction, he would say, O Allah, I seek refuge in thee from care and sorrow, from incapacity and laziness, from stinginess and cowardice, and seek refuge to thee from the burden of debt and from being humbled by people.
What does the power of generosity do for the other person and do for you, the giver?
Giver's gain. I think the giver enjoys more than the receiver. And I'm convinced that giving is one of the basic rules of success. Well, you know, Emerson said that cause and effect was the law of laws. Action and reaction are equal and opposite. So it's in harmony with the laws of the universe. And I believe this whole universe operates in a very orderly way. I'm very tuned into laws, the laws of the universe. And I think that's why. When I could win, anybody can win. Yeah. It's just a matter of getting the right information from the right people. Mm-hmm. I think we get too much information from the wrong people.
Yeah.
And personal development today is such a well-known thing. That for anybody not to be developing themselves personally is rather sad, I think.
Yeah. You know?
So we have to help them as all we can. Like, I don't think a person deliberately destroys himself. I think they're misguided.
Yeah.
They're ignorant. They don't know.
Yeah.
They're lost.
Yeah.
Thank you, dear brother and sister, for listening to this episode of today's special, in which we spoke about the etiquette of lending money. Shall we follow this topic? Till the next time, fi amanillah.
Told me that I'm crazy, who you're praying for. They told me there is nothing, who you're looking for. Stop doing what you're doing, cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they showed me all kind of lies. My eyes were locked, yes I was mesmerized. But deep inside I know that there's a better world. Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer. Tonight, a tiny angel sleeps on my knees. She's only 5 years old, but her heart's bigger than the seas. Tonight, our house is filled with the sound of the angel's wings. She has so many more friends in the skies than on the earth. Oh, my daughter, you're my soul. You're my calm in the storm. All my dreams will come true. Dream of a holy sun rising and this dead world starting to bloom. Oh, my daughter, you're my soul, you're my calm in the storm. All my dreams have come true 'cause of you.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today we're diving into a short, striking saying from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, peace be upon him. He said, "It is not appropriate for a woman to perfume her clothes when she goes out of her house." Now, you might think, perfume? Really? Why would something so small matter? But actually, it matters a lot. Let's unpack why. This isn't about banning scent or suppressing beauty or women. It's about why we present ourselves a certain way. When someone puts on perfume before going out, I mean the women, especially a scent designed to attract, it sends an unspoken signal. Notice me. That's not always wrong, but Islam wants us to question the intention. Am I doing this for confidence or for attention? Am I creating space for connection or distraction? Distraction. The Imam here is inviting women to preserve a sense of dignity, privacy, and focus in public spaces. And that advice is as relevant today as it was 13 or 14 centuries ago. Let's pull in a bit of science. Studies in neuroscience show that scent is one of the strongest triggers of memory and emotion. According to research published in Frontiers in Psychology, certain scents instantly grab attention and even affect mood and perception. So when a strong fragrance enters a room, it actually pulls cognitive energy from others around, whether they want it or not. In marketing, companies know this well. That's why scent is used in malls and showrooms to shape your behavior without words. Now, imagine this power being used in a crowded bus, school hallway, or anywhere. The Imam's advice isn't just spiritual, it's psychologically grounded. Okay, so what do we do with this? First, let's recognize that modesty is not just about covering the body, it's about controlling impact. The way we speak, walk, and even smell can either protect our space or invite unnecessary attention. Second, we can choose scents or self-care routines that are personal, calming, and respectful of shared spaces, especially in public settings. And third, this isn't about fear, it's about power. Real empowerment is the ability to choose what part of you is the world sees and what stays private, sacred, and yours. So the more we take control of how we show up in this world, the more peaceful and purposeful life becomes. We start performing, we start being. So let your presence speak through your character, not your perfume. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
activists who do not just challenge systems, they confront them head on. They blur the lines between protest and provocation, pushing public discourse into uncomfortable but necessary territory. Their work is often polarizing, but it's rooted in a deep conviction to dismantle injustice. My guest today is one such activist. Welcome to SOAR. I am Bahman Roy.
Calla Walsh is an American political activist, writer and organizer known for outspoken views on U.S. foreign policy, anti-imperialism and Palestinian solidarity. She is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and co-chair of the National Network on Cuba. Walsh has contributed to different media outlets and has participated in delegations to Cuba and Syria. In 2023, she was arrested during direct actions targeting Elbit Systems, an Israeli military contractor, as part of a work with Palestine Action US. Calla Walsh, it's a pleasure to have you on SOAP.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I know you must be very tired, but let me just get to the first question. We'll take it from there. What first sparked your interest in activism and political organizing?
I think the first issue that really sparked my interest was the climate crisis, and I quickly realized that we cannot stop the climate crisis without stopping imperialism, and that imperialism is the greatest destroyer of the environment in the world. And I think at first, as a kid in the United States, we aren't taught to care about any country except ourselves. But as my process of getting involved politically developed, I realized the necessity of fighting against U.S.-led imperialism.
Right. And were there formative experiences growing up that shaped your worldview?
Well, I was 12 years old when Donald Trump was elected, and certainly I don't think Donald Trump is an aberration in the long, long history of fascist, genocidal, racist U.S. presidents, but there was a huge spark of political activity and protest and momentum in that moment, and I got involved at a very young age in different movements, whether it was the Women's March, the March for Our Lives against gun violence, and later the 2020 protests against police violence and racism and brutality. And I was involved in many different ways of protesting, of organizing. And as I know we're going to talk about, one of those very formative experiences was working on campaigns and really trying to work within the system like we are told to, and trying to use all these legal means to make change, and realizing over time that politicians don't work for the people, they work for weapons companies and oil companies, and that we need to use other tactics and strategies to make change.
Right. I'm just curious, you were a 12-year-old lady when Donald Trump came into office for the very, very first time. So that's such a young age. How would such a young girl get interested even in the politics of these things? You know, what familial background helped you shape that sort of worldview?
Well, I grew up in the United States, but my family is Irish-American. Uh-huh. I've never been to Ireland. My family and my extended family, we aren't very connected to our Irish heritage or background. But once I started to learn about settler colonialism in the U.S. and how this entire American identity, just like the Israeli settler Zionist identity, is a genocidal construct that is built upon the blood of the indigenous peoples of North America, just like the Zionist entity is built upon the blood of the Palestinian people.
Right.
And so connecting to where I'm truly from, where my family is truly from, and learning the fierce, militant history of resistance in Ireland to colonialism, to imperialism, and solidarity with the Palestinian cause, I think gave me a much, much deeper understanding of what struggle means.
Of
and
course.
That it's something that my people have been partaking in for 800 years against colonialism.
So this must have also been kind of a trigger for you to go and study the heritage and the background and what happened with the Irish cause.
That's
very interesting, of course. How did your early involvement in climate justice evolve into broader anti-imperialist work?
Like I said, I was part of, a lot of climate organizing, of youth groups such as the Youth Climate Strike, and most of our actions were focused on asking politicians to change their policy. I participated in protests outside the White House, in the halls of Congress, begging our elected officials to listen to us to protect our future. And what I realized is that, asking politely the people in power to, make change that actually works against their own interests when these politicians' campaigns are funded by, all these corporations. And even many of the politicians who claim to be pro green energy, pro sustainability, such as Ed Markey, who I believe we're going to discuss in a bit. Many of them, talk this talk, but in reality, they support the U.S. military, which is the greatest polluter on planet Earth and has caused more environmental destruction and pollution than any other entity on planet Earth. And so, what I realized is that imperialism is the primary contradiction in the world today, and that is what we need to focus our struggle on, because it encompasses every single issue. We can't have climate justice, we can't have women's rights, we can't have fair housing and any of the things we want to see while we live in a system of global exploitation and constant war and genocide, which is what the U.S. and Zionist and NATO empire feed off of.
Right. Now, I'm going to talk about a little bit about the digital organizing and the youth movements that you were part of. What was it like helping build the Markeyverse and mobilizing Gen Z voters? Tell me about that.
First, let me just say it's crazy to hear that term said on Iranian TV, but that was
I did my own work.
It was a big effort that I was involved in. Flash forward a couple years after I got involved politically, the COVID pandemic hit. I was 15. I was a sophomore in high school, and suddenly I was stuck at home and locked inside. And so all of the organizing that I was doing shifted to the digital sphere. Yeah. And a lot of adults and folks, working in political organizations and campaigns didn't know how to use the tools of social media to mobilize young people in the way that young people who are just fluent in these platforms do. And we innovated really creative techniques to turn out young voters. And we really emphasized, the candidate that we were supporting, Ed Markey, his stance on the Green New Deal, on progressive legislation that we supported. But in retrospect, a lot of that legislation, it was simply to improve the lives of people living in the U.S. And that is predicated upon the continuation of the, exploitation of the global south, the continuation of these wars and these genocides. And I still learned a lot from those experiences. I've arrived at the politics I have today by trying all these different tactics and strategies and realizing, what is futile versus what actually poses a threat to the ruling class and to our oppressors.
Right. And how do you see digital activism changing the landscape of political engagement?
To borrow a phrase from Fidel Castro, I think the battle of ideas is being waged on social media. And so we cannot write off the digital sphere, we cannot write off these platforms as important battlegrounds for us to wage ideological struggle, to counter imperialist propaganda. If we look at how, the CIA and various imperialist agencies' investments and strategies and budgets have shifted over the past decades, increasingly so much is being invested on propagandizing through the digital sphere. You know, I think some really good examples are the regime change attempts in Cuba and in Iran, which attempt to portray themselves as, you know, organic, homegrown protest movements, but in reality are usually hashtags that were created in Washington, D.C. or Langley, Virginia. And that's why I'm so honored to be here, because what I do have is a platform where I can, you know, share the reality that I'm seeing. And while I don't claim to be an expert on anything, really, I do think that, you know, having young people from the United States see this reality and see, you know, the destruction of that is caused by the U.S. Zionist aggression, and to bring back those lessons to people in the U.S. To understand is absolutely essential.
Well, you know, Carla, we are living in a world with mainstream media having the final say in many, many of the events that we are surrounded by. How do you make yourself heard by the people around you while they are also all being bombarded by these mainstream media regarding the truth that you have uncovered?
I think that's another, you know, change that's been caused by the shift to digital platforms and social media is, although mainstream media is dominant in many ways, social media kind of democratizes how we receive news. And so regular people, yes, despite, you know, not working for the BBC or CNN or MSNBC, we can create a platform for ourselves. And I think often that is so much more compelling to our audience and to people who want to understand what is happening in the world, because frankly, mainstream media is very dishonest, and I think the average person is smart enough to realize that and to be disillusioned with it. And the fact is they ignore, you know, the vast majority of what is actually happening in the world. And so to create our own platforms and to elevate our own voices, and to speak the truth and without fear of being critical of power and of capital and of the imperialist ruling class is a great task, but I think it is one that we are seeing great progress on, and that consciousness is greatly shifting, yeah, especially among young people, and that is why the U.S. is trying to crack down on platforms like TikTok. That is why there is so much increasing censorship on platforms like Meta. I, of course, have been suspended many times on these platforms, but nevertheless, we have to continue to get our word out there, and we also need to be creative with how we disseminate ideas, because yeah, increasingly, the censorship is only going to get worse, and we can't only be reliant on, you know, platforms that are controlled by our enemy.
Tell me something. I think within the American scene, and the issue of censorship, I think it's getting harder and harder to get a message across. Do you think it's always been like that, or it has become visibly worse? Which one do you think it is?
I think it's both. You know, I think freedom of speech has always been a lie. It's uh-huh. freedom of speech for those who the government feels
almost
like it.
Almost everywhere.
Yes, but I do think we've seen some qualitative escalations and crackdowns in both the U.S. and in the so-called United Kingdom and in Europe. Yeah. I would point to, you know, the prescription of Palestine action in the U.K. Right. as a really extreme example, and you know, our comrades there, they can't even say the words Palestine action without potentially being charged with terrorism. And in the United States, you know, it's not quite there yet, but we are seeing so many people being fired from their workplaces, being kicked out of their universities for mere anti-Zionist speech. You know, the sacrifice of losing a job or losing a degree is minuscule compared to what Palestinians are sacrificing, compared to what Iranians are sacrificing, compared to what, you know, the people in the entire global south, and especially the Axis of Resistance countries, are experiencing under U.S. Zionist imperialism. And so, in my view, the best way to respond to the censorship is to double down and to be louder than ever, because the louder that we are, the harder it is for them to silence us. And they actually can't possibly, you know, repress us all if we are all speaking out in support of the Palestinian resistance. And so while I expect for there to be more, for there to be more lawfare, for there to be more attempts to crush free speech, nevertheless, I think we have to, you know, double down on our pro-resistance speech. And, you know, I wanna shout out especially the organization Samizdat, which was designated in Canada and the U.S., and there were restrictions placed on it because they support the Palestinian resistance and because they fight for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. And there was a lot of fear that was instilled in people in the movement that if they even say, you know, I stand by Sami Noon because of this, during this, you know, phony designation, there's a lot of fear that that could, you know, even lead to people being targeted. But if we all stand together and if we all, you know, stand in solidarity with people facing repression, it is impossible for them to be isolated. So, yes, I think it's important to use these moments of the intensified repression to build more unity in our principles of resistance and steadfastness.
Right. And after working on, well, of course, you worked on Senator Markey's campaign. What led you to your disenchantment with electoral politics?
I'd certainly been, you know, slowly getting disenchanted over time. I think my values and my principles were always far more radical than what could be expressed in an electoral campaign. But those were the opportunities that I found to get involved in change. And I realized, especially after taking part in protests in 2020, and then especially after what happened in Palestine in May 2021, the evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, the Six-Day War, and the bombardment of Gaza, that woke me up to the reality of imperialism and of the Zionist genocide against Palestine. And what I can only understand is my own complicity in that up until the moment that I broke with the US states and working within the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party is, you know, just as genocidal and imperialist as the Republican Party. They just have different tactics and strategies through which they hold on to power. And like I said, I, you know, had worked for the senator, I'd worked for many politicians, and just seeing, you know, how horrific the bombardment was and also how heroic the Palestinian response, the response of the resistance in Gaza was firing back at the Zionist entity, I realized it was a moment where I had to make a choice that would define the trajectory for the rest of my life, which was to split with this liberal, reformist, social imperialist part of the, you know, movement that I was in, and to self-criticize, to use that as an opportunity to bring more people over to being pro-Palestine, to being anti-Zionist. We started a pressure campaign on the senator to try to get him to change his stance, and the failure of that to get him to change his stance also made me realize that even though that was someone I'd worked for and invested my labor in and helped him win the election, that my voice made no difference compared to checks from AIPAC or checks from Zionist donors or from weapons companies or his investment in U.S. interests. And so after that, I became much more involved in the pro-Palestine movement, and I basically completely left electoral politics, and from there on out spoke very vocally about how I feel like electoralism is ultimately, you know, counterinsurgent, and that we need to make a firm, clean break and to work outside of these institutions to, you know, create something new, to build an alternative to empire.
Right. And of course, you were involved with politics for a while. Did you find different voices? Like, for example, what we hear from Senator Bernie Sanders. Did you see that sort of voices often within the politics, within the mechanics and the machination of the mechanics of politics in the U.S.? Such voices, are they just rare, Well, there are still more than just one person in there thinking the way he does.
I think that I see, you know, I see Bernie Sanders, I see Ed Markey, I see AOC and the Squad. Even, you know, Zohran Mamdani, who just won this election in New York. I still see this progressive, or someone called like Democratic Socialist wing of the Democratic Party. I see it as a concerted effort to try to bring young people back into the Democratic Party because they have lost so much support because of Palestine. Because young people saw the Democratic Party carry out a Holocaust for 2 years, live streamed before our own eyes. No wonder people aren't coming out and weren't voting for Kamala Harris. And I think the Democrats realize that, and they realize they need younger, more progressive people who will say Free Palestine as a slogan to try to get people back into voting them and working in the party. But these people are not anti-Zionist. They're not anti-imperialist. They constantly defend Israel's right to exist. They constantly condemn the Palestinian resistance and the entire axis of resistance. They constantly promote, you know, regime change and sanctions against Iran. And so I think while it's positive to heighten the contradictions within within Congress, within the Democratic Party, within the U.S. government, electing these politicians is not a means to an end. And we have to be very, very careful with, you know, how working within these institutions might force us to compromise our principles. And so that's why I'm very openly critical of them.
Right, I see. And do you believe progressive candidates can still drive meaningful change within the system?
I think at the local level, that argument could be made. But I think, as I just argued, you know, I think fundamentally,
I kind of got my answer.
Yeah, it's I see it as, you know, a part of like the counterinsurgency. And I think when we have these huge ruptures and shifts of consciousness, like after the Al-Aqsa flood, there was a huge burst of, you know, anti-imperialist consciousness in the United States. And I think one of the responses by the Zionists, by the imperialists, by the ruling class is to try to capture that enemy, that energy, to try to capture that energy and to funnel it into something that is fundamentally not challenging or threatening to U.S. empire. And so they would much rather have us be working on a campaign than, say, doing direct action against a weapons company.
Carla Walsh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Of course. And thank you for being with us on another soap. Thank you so much and goodbye until next time.
Welcome, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start this hour's lineup with Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. After that, we have Islamic upbringing. The program aims to answer frequently asked questions about children and adolescents and their upbringing. Israel Watch will follow next. The program aims to examine and criticize reports and analysis by Israeli media on current events and issues in West Asia region. And the Ocean of Dua is our final program this hour. The program gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamilu Ziyarat. Stay with us for the next hour.
Let's recite the Quran.
وَإِذَا قَرَأْتَ الْقُرْآنَ جَعَلْنَا بَيْنَكَ وَبَيْنَ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْآخِرَةِ حِجَابًا مَسْتُورًا.
القرآن نور وبيان، القرآن هدي الإيمان، القرآن مسك الختام.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners, listening to IRB English Radio right now from all over the world. Welcome to Let's Recite the Quran in Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. I'm Habibullah Fasihzadeh, together with brothers Ali Nasir, Hassan Nasrullah, Hussein Ruhullah, and Muhammad Masum, right? So everyone is here. I really welcome you all. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Just Ali Nasir? So guys, alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah inshallah. Let's get it started. Today we will be practicing verse number 26, Surah Al-Ra'd, on page 252. So brothers and sisters, dear listeners, open the Quran, turn to page 252, Surah Al-Ra'd, verse 26.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. الله يبسط الرزق لمن يشاء ويقدر وفرحوا بالحياة الدنيا وما الحياة الدنيا في الآخرة إلا متاع.
Allah extends provision for whom He wills and restricts it, and they rejoice in the worldly life, while the worldly life is not compared to the hereafter, except brief enjoyment.
That was a nice recitation, mashallah. Allah bless the reciter, inshallah. So, verse 26 talks about a very, very important issue. I'll tell you some of the points. Then, inshallah, I really want you to refer to the Tafsir books if you want to learn more about this ayah. So, let me read once. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allah Almighty says in ayah 26 of Surah Al-Ra'd, verse 26, Surah Al-Ra'd, page 252, that Allahu yabsutu ar-rizqa liman yasha'u wa yaqdir. Allah expands the provision for whomever He wishes and tightens it. وَفَرِحُوا بِالْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا. They, the people, exult in the life of this world. وَمَا الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا فِي الْآخِرَةِ إِلَّا مَتَاعٌ. But the life of here at this world, compared with the hereafter, the life of this world is nothing but a trifling enjoyment. It's just a temporary enjoyment. Okay? So guys, this ayah talks about a very, very important issue, and that is the reality of this world. The reality of this world of dunya. The reality of dunya. And also there's one more point that that Allah mentions in this ayah. That is Allah's power. Allah's what? Power. That it's in the control of Allah to either expand the rizq to whomever he wishes or tightens it.